Welcome again to the Comic Book Historian Podcast. I'm Alex Grant, and I'm here with Jim Thompson. Jim, how are you doing, Alex? Today?
Good.
Great to see that face of yours again. So we have a special guest today. We have Trina Robbins, who is a seminal figure in comics history and definitely a giant as far as 20th century comic books and a 21st century comic book historian. And so, Trina, thank you so much for joining us today. Jim, take it away.
Hi, Trina.
Hi.
I wanted to start at the very beginning with when you were born and where you grew up. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I was born in Brooklyn. I grew up in Queens.
What did your father and your mother do?
My mother was a school teacher who taught me to read at the age of 4, which is the most wonderful thing anyone has ever done for me, except, of course, give birth to me, which she also did. My father had been a tailor, but he had Parkinson's disease. And for most of my memory, he couldn't sew any. Well, he did sew at home, but he couldn't sew professionally anymore. But he was also a writer. He wrote in Yiddish. Mm. And in those days, there were lots of Yiddish language newspapers in New York. And he wrote for them. He wrote articles for them. And as he, I'm sure you know, he wrote a book.
Yes. He was also a chicken farmer?
No, he wanted to be a chicken farmer. Toms River, New Jersey, as I later found out, was a hotbed of Jewish chicken farms. And he did own land there, and he wanted to move there and open a chicken farm. But of course, it was really pretty impossible, since my mother really supported the family, and she was a teacher. And, you know, she could really not, you know, commute from Toms River, New Jersey to Queens, where she taught. So really, all that I remember is that he had a book on chicken diseases, and it was color. You saw, you know, these diseased chickens in full color with bright red sores. And wow. I was fascinated. I used to pore over that book. I was fascinated by the pictures.
Oh, that's interesting. You mentioned you being an early reader. And I've noticed that in most of the interviews we've done with comic creators, Alex got it with Jim Steranko and also with Rick Marshall. They all comment on being extremely early readers. Do you think that has something to do with an early attraction to comic books as well?
I don't know, but smart kids are usually early readers and smart kids read comics. So there's a connection there.
There you go. I like that.
I like that too. That's good. Which brings me to my next question. When did you start reading comics and what comics were you reading?
Well, at first my mother brought them home. You had to cross two streets to get to the corner candy store that sold the comics. So when I was too little to cross the two streets on my own, my mother would bring comics home for me. They were the nice little kid comics, you know, like Gold Medal. Was it Gold Medal that did those great comics? Or, you know, like they printed Pogo and they printed Animal Comics. Was it Gold Medal? Someone tell me, please.
I'm not sure.
Gold Key did that. Yeah, Dell and Gold
really
Key, yes.
Yes. And they had great comics for kids. And my mother approved of them because in the lettering, in the speech balloons, they used caps and small letters
rather
than all caps. And as a teacher, she really didn't like the idea of the speech balloons that were all caps because that was not proper. So the first ones I read were Gold Key comics that my mother approved of.
Do you mean Dell comics?
Was it Dell, not Gold Key?
Probably Dell, because Gold Key was more of a 60s transformation of Dell comics.
Okay. So
I bet they were Dell comics. Yeah. And I remember Dell, they were very wholesome and they had that slogan, yes. Dell comics are good comics. So that's the generation of comics you were probably reading.
Yes. I remember they had Animal Comics. They had Our Gang comics. They definitely had Pogo.
Oh, that's great.
Our Gang was also Walt Kelly, just like Pogo was.
Yeah. So I was reading Pogo. I was reading Will Kelly at an early age, yes.
So was that in the 50s then or 40s. Later 40s? In the 40s, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, mm-hmm. in the 40s. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Now, that would have been before you graduated after that at some point to the Atlas comics, Millie the Model and those. You were reading those first.
Yeah, they weren't Atlas. They were Timely.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was when I finally was old enough, about 10, I guess, maybe 9 or 10, old enough to cross the two streets and buy comics on my own with my allowance. And basically, I would buy any comic that had a woman or a girl on the cover
right.
in control, not tied to a chair and being rescued, but in control as the protagonist of the comics. I was never interested in the male superheroes. I found them unbelievably boring.
You were a great lover of Captain Marvel.
Yes, he was the only male superhero I liked. And he was, of course, Mary Marvel's brother, which is how I met him, because first I met Mary Marvel. He was drawn in such an accessible way, really C.C. Beck, that clean, clean, accessible styles, very warm and very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And you mm-hmm. later became friends with C.C. Beck, didn't you?
I did, and I treasure that friendship.
That's wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about him as a person?
I met him in 1977, my first San Diego Comic-Con, and he was so lovely. He had brought a guitar, and I remember him singing these, they were supposed to be kind of like off-color bawdy ballads, but they were really very tame, of course. And they're very sweet and very funny. And we just made friends. And he had a circle of fans that he corresponded with. And I became part of that circle.
Oh, nice.
Now, you've never gotten to draw Mary Marvel or do any work, except for an occasional cover or something. Would you have liked to have gotten to do something with those characters?
Oh, back in the days when I drew, I would have loved to have drawn Mary Marvel. Sure.
Yeah. And did you bring a lot of that Mary Marvel and Millie the Model into your Misty comics that you did in the 80s? Like, would you say a lot of that was influenced into there? Or was it more your own life experiences that would go into that?
Well, Misty was definitely an offshoot of Millie the Model because she was Millie's niece.
Right.
And that was continuity that got it into Marvel Comics.
Right.
But Mary Marvel, in the 90s and early 21st century, I collaborated with Ann Timmons on a series called Go Girl. It was about a teenage flying heroine.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very influenced by Mary Marvel.
I see. That's nice.
Now, you were also doing the Timely Girls. There's also Katie Keene as well, correct?
Katie was not Timely.
No, I know.
She comes.
In that
yes,
time, yeah.
Yeah, you know, everyone who is now a certain age, all the women loved Katie Keene. I mean, this is an interesting connection, but I actually have been taking Yiddish classes.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not just Yiddish classes, but they're senior Yiddish classes. And they're not just senior Yiddish classes, but they're senior LGBT Yiddish classes.
Oh, wow.
At the LGBT Senior Center. You know, it's a great class and everyone's friends and we'll start talking about, we'll get off topic, right? And somebody started talking about the old comics that they remembered. The teacher started, he liked The Little King. He talked about Otto Sagla's The Little King. And we started talking about comics and I mentioned Katie Keene and all of the women went, oh, Katie Keene, yes. You know, every little girl in the 40s and 50s loved Katie Keene through the 60s, the early 60s.
It was a real cultural phenomenon with the women readers at the time. That's great.
Girl readers,
although
sure women read it too.
And you were attracted also to the paper dolls aspect of it as well. Do you think that's when you started to think about fashion was partly because of or in connection with those?
I always loved paper dolls. I made my own. I had brown paper grocery bags filled with my paper dolls. And I would constantly design more clothes for them. But they were always in the same pose. I would redraw the dolls as I got better at drawing, but they would always be in the same pose so they could wear all the clothes I had designed for them.
We were talking about the paper dolls and the clothing. And so you were interested in the fashion aspect of these comics as well. That's correct?
Yes.
And what about other women in comics at that time? I know you have a great love for Fiction House.
Yes. They published during the war and afterwards, too, really, in the late 40s, they published more women cartoonists than any of the other companies. And that's during the war when everyone was publishing women cartoonists, all the comic book companies, because the guys were all fighting. They still published more than any of the others. And the best, these women were great.
So were you reading Fiction House as a kid or did that come later when you were doing research?
You know, as soon as I could discover comics, I loved their Jungle comics. I was a huge Sheena fan. I was buying the Jungle comics. My mother was a little alarmed because, you know, the girls were kind of sexy. But, mm-hmm. you know, by today's standards, they're just pretty girls. You know, you've seen Bad Girl comics and how horrendous they are. But even though my mother was alarmed, she never censored me.
Oh, good.
Now, this opened you up to a lot of different genres, too, because Fiction House was great at covering a lot of different...
Oh, my God, their science fiction title, Planet Comics, yes.
Now, I have been looking at other companies during the same period. I'm finding a lot of women, surprising number of women in Ace and in Harvey and some of those as well.
Timely Comics.
And Timely Comics, yes. Who was working at Timely?
Oh, wow. Starting in 1944 with the first Miss America magazine, which, as you know, was a girl's mag that also had comics in it. You had Miss America and also Patsy Walker, originating in 1944, drawn by Pauline Loth. Also drawn by Christopher Rule, who, in my opinion, is one of the greatest, greatest cartoonists who ever lived. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a very small Christopher Rule Appreciation Society, but I certainly belong to it. So that was 44. Then in 45, Ruth Atkinson drew the first year of Patsy Walker comics. See, originally Patsy Walker was in Miss America comics as just one comic in the magazine.
Right. As a one-shot.
And by 45, she was so successful that they did Patsy Walker comics. That's when they started Millie the Model comics. And Ruth Atkinson drew the first year of Patsy Walker. She drew the first Millie the Model comic book. And also in that first year of Patsy Walker, drawn by Ruth Atkinson, there would be three Patsy Walker stories drawn by her and one Patsy Walker story contributed by Fran Hopper. It was practically an all-woman deal there.
Yeah.
And why did that change? What caused women to almost virtually disappear from a lot of these companies?
Guys came back from the war and they wanted their old jobs back. That's exactly what happened. But they were still, you know, like the Timely teen titles from the late 40s and 50s. I loved them. And, you know, they were drawn by guys at that point, but they were still, they were vibrant and alive and exciting and about teenage girls. And really that continued. They started falling apart in the 60s, just about when Marvel, you know, started its superhero renaissance. And they just devoted themselves, because the superheroes were doing so well, they devoted themselves to the superheroes and threw the girl titles under the bus.
Huh. Now, I'm going to skip ahead just for a minute, just because of what you're saying. You had given up comics for a while, but you came back in terms of EC comics because of the your love for the science fiction books and because of Mad. Now, they did not have very many women working for them, correct?
No, they didn't. Marie Severin, the colorist, and that was it.
Just as far as sci-fi, so you were saying you were reading Planet Comics, and then also you're reading the EC comics, and you got involved with sci-fi fandom, right, in the later 50s. Mm-hmm. There was a Hugo Award-nominated fanzine, Habakkuk. Am I saying it correctly?
Yes.
Would you have had considered yourself a sci-fi fan by this point?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. I discovered science fiction at about 14, and except for what I had to read for school, uh-huh. I would say that from 14 to about 18, all I read was science fiction.
Oh, I see. What was it about science fiction that you liked? Was it about like the technological aspect, or was it more like they would put social things within a fantastic setting, social discussions in a fantastic setting? What was it about sci-fi that drew you to it?
Well, really, it was everything. I mean, it was mind-opening. I was the only kid in maybe one of two kids in my school who read science fiction, you know, and they thought we were weird. You know, science fiction was just weird kids read that stuff. And it was completely mind-opening.
Right.
You know, the concept. I mean, now they're so corny and we know them so well. You know, what if you go back through time and marry your husband or your father or whatever?
Right.
They're so obvious now, but they were just mind-blowing in those days because they were new.
That's true.
Discovering Bradbury, you know, and like, again, it's, you know, we know this stuff now and it's old hat, but at the time, you know, wow, what if the Martians were big-eyed, wonderful people, but then we came and we destroyed them all with our diseases. Wow. You know, I mean, this was amazing stuff to me because it was new.
Yeah, that's great. How did you get involved with the sci-fi fanzines? Was it through like fan letters of comics? Or how did that happen?
My two best friends I met through a letter to a science fiction magazine when I was 14. I just wrote a letter saying, you know, are there any other fans, you know, in Queens? And I'm 14 and I'm blonde and I have green eyes. Uh-huh. And two boys immediately called me, my friends, David and Marty. And they became my best friends, teenagers my age. And we would meet in David's father had fixed up the basement with like a ping pong table and stuff, hoping that David would, you know, be a regular boy and play ping pong. But we never used the ping pong table. And we just hung out and talked about science fiction.
Oh, that's great.
You know, you said when you were around 14, it's probably not a coincidence that your mom asked you told you to stop buying comics the year before that, approximately.
Yes.
So science fiction came up partly because you weren't allowed to read comics anymore. Is that right?
I wasn't forbidden. No, no, you mustn't say we weren't allowed. My mother simply said to me, you're in high school now, you're a teenager, comics are kid stuff, why don't you stop reading comics? She never, my parents were very permissive, but I simply went, oh yeah, okay, you're right, and stopped reading comics.
And then you came back when people showed you Mad Magazine and the EC stuff.
No, I didn't come back to comics. I just came back to Mad Comics and EC. That's different, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wally Wood was one of your favorites. You later got to meet him, what, in the late 60s?
Yes.
What was your impression of Wally when you met? Was he a nice guy? Was he, what was your impression with that?
Wally was a very nice guy. He had a studio where younger people, you know, young guys were assisting him. And I could have, at that certain point, I moved to San Francisco in 1970. Mm-hmm. If I had stayed and not, you know, I could have been part of that group.
Oh, and wow.
That I couldn't have, you know, three lives and one of them be Woody's assistant.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Before that, before you moved, your first comics were for the East Village Other, an underground
yes.
newspaper in New York City.
Yes.
And they published the Goth Blimp Works, which was a comic you worked on in 69. Was this your intro to underground comics? Tell us about that.
Well, I was still living in Los Angeles in 66 when someone showed me the East Village Other. Every major city at that point, and college towns too, had one underground newspaper. In L.A., ours was the L.A. Free Press, and I did hang out with the L.A. Free Press crowd, and I even did one four-panel comic for them. But then someone showed me the East Village Other, and they had comics, and their comics were, well, the word underground comics didn't exist yet. I called them hip comics because
Oh, okay.
They talked about our culture, counterculture, mm-hmm. rather than short-haired superheroes punching each other out, you know?
Right.
It was something I could relate to. In particular, I've never forgotten, there was this one full-page comic called Gentle's Trip Out, and it was signed Panzeca, and it was totally, totally psychedelic. It didn't really have a story or anything. It was just very psychedelic. And I thought, this is what I want to do. And, you know, like 2 years later, when I was in New York, I met Panzeca, who turned out to be a woman. So
oh.
This was really maybe my first ever comics influence was a woman.
Oh, that's awesome.
Trina, I want to go back to the earlier years just for a little bit. We were talking about comic books, but we haven't talked about comic strips. And I know that you were also an avid reader of comic strips during this time. We haven't talked about your family's politics, but my understanding is they were a fairly liberal family living in a community of more conservative people.
Very left-wing family living in an extremely bigoted right-wing neighborhood.
And in fact, you had to sneak out to read Hearst newspapers. Is that correct?
That's right. He wouldn't allow the Hearst newspapers in the house because they were fascist rags. And of course, they were fascist rags, but they had great comics. Hearst had great taste in comics.
So you would actually go out and take someone else's in the mornings and read it and then put the newspapers back?
Oh, that was the Daily News. No, the Journal American was the Hearst paper, and they had the best comics. And I would read that over the houses of my friends when I was visiting my friends. I would read their Journal Americans. The Daily News really actually had terrible comics, but they had Brenda Starr. That was the only one that I was interested in, the Daily News. And my landlady subscribed to the Daily News. So I would go downstairs and pick up the paper when it landed at her door and bring it upstairs and unfold it and read Brenda Starr and then refold it and put it back down in front of my landlady's door.
So you were reading comic strips that did have some political commentary, like Barnaby and Pogo were two of your favorites.
Yes. Well, of course, Pogo ran in the Post, which was left wing, and Barnaby ran in Someone Has to Write a Book About This Really Interesting Newspaper Called, it went through three changes. First, it was the PM, then it was the Compass, and then it was the Star. Mm. But they all had the same really, really, really good writers, really classic writers, and really good taste. And they always folded because they wouldn't take advertising because they were so pure. And that was what my father brought home. He brought home the PM. When it was the Star, I think not the PM or the Compass, but when it was the Star, it carried Spirit Sunday strips. The Spirit Sunday.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yes. 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 And they had like the best comics, you know, Barnaby. Yes. Barnaby was just amazing. And I think it might have been the Compass that Walt Kelly was actually the art director on. But it was one of those. But so there's this amazing phenomenon of this newspaper that went through three name changes and three different owners, but was always really the same newspaper. And why hasn't someone written a book about this?
Interesting.
Now, you mentioned Eisner. You were also a tremendous fan of the Spirit.
Loved the Spirit Sunday sections. Yes, God, yes.
And they had great women characters, too, didn't they?
They did. They did. His women were so strong. Even if the Spirit was the protagonist, there was always a strong woman in there. And they were great characters.
And such a variety. At the time, they had such individual personalities.
Yes.
So then, as we said, you had gotten into science fiction and you were hanging out with some new friends, but also because it was a community, you were invited to New York and were part of a group that also included older men that were inviting basically the 15-year-old girls to come and join and talk about science fiction.
I met these people at a local convention at a New York Comic Con. Maybe my, not Comic Con, Science Fiction Con, probably my first Science Fiction Con. And there were all these people, and they were all older guys in their 30s. And Marty, my friend Marty and I, we were like 15. We were invited to hang out with them. Nice. And it was kind of, well, nice, a little weird, you know, because, I mean, nobody tried anything, I promise you that. But there was a lot of innuendos running around, you know, and I didn't get them. They went over my head. I didn't know what was going on.
Were you reading Science Fiction Digests and Pulps too?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, I like
yes, the Pulps were great. But I also read Fantasy and Science Fiction and Galaxy.
Galaxy, yeah. Okay, that's cool. Were you able to like tell, you know, if that was a Wally Wood picture or if that or...
Woody was so recognizable. First of all, he was the first artist, cartoon artist I was aware of because in those days, nobody was credited. But Woody would sign his strips, you know, with that fancy Gothic wood. So I knew what was by Wally Wood.
Oh, that's cool. Interesting. So then with the sci-fi conventions with these older guys and stuff, it was not just about comics. It was also about pulps and magazines and just the genre in general, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
You met Harlan Ellison around this time.
At a science fiction convention in New York, yes.
And the two of you became friends?
I dated him. He was 5 years older than me. First thing he did when he met me was ask me how tall I was. And then when it turned out that I was shorter than him, he asked me out. I was 16 and he was 21.
Oh, okay.
So what was he like as a 21-year-old? Was he the same as he was later in life?
It was the same. Harlan has always been the same as he always has been. Yes, yes. He had just sold his first book, which was, I think, the original name was Rumble, but then they, when they reprinted it, they gave it a classier title, something about the city. I don't remember exactly, but it was the book where he talked about running with a teenage gang in disguise. And he insisted it had really happened, but I didn't really believe him.
And you reconnected with him later in Los Angeles when you came out there.
Yes, out there. Yes, he was in my caress somewhere. Wherever I went, there was Harlan.
You have a tiny movie connection with him too, correct?
Yes, that awful movie, The Oscar, which even Harlan agreed was the worst movie ever made. He had a character named Trina, played by Edie Adams. And he said he had based it on me. So Edie wanted to meet me since she was going to be playing the character. So we met her on this at the studio for lunch. And she was wonderful. And I don't think the character was the least bit like me, but that's okay.
But the name is there. The name is there.
So you stayed involved in science fiction. You finished high school, and then you went to college for one year.
I dropped out of two very good colleges, yes.
Were those in New York?
One was Queens College, and the other was Cooper Union that was in Manhattan. Cooper Union was the art school.
I see. What year was that when you left there, Cooper Union?
That would be the late 50s.
Oh, okay. Okay. I gotcha. So then in the 60s, then you were working mostly in the, well, the East Village Other and all that was 69, late 60s.
66. So, no, yes, I came 66. To New York in 66 and almost immediately was published in the East Village Other.
What prompted your move to San Francisco in 1970?
The underground comic scene. It was just a new art form. It was very revolutionary. The idea that you could do comics that were not Spider-Man or Batman, you know, that were counterculture. It was a brand new art form, and it was very exciting, and it was very vigorous and very alive. The comic books were coming out of San Francisco. That's where they were coming from. So it was like the mecca of underground comics, and there was like really, I call it a lemming-like migration of underground cartoonists from New York to San Francisco starting around 1969 and through 1971.
Right. That all kind of coincides, right, with the movement of the late 60s, like Woodstock and all that stuff, right? That's all, that all just kind of goes together, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And then at that point, you worked on a San Francisco-based underground publisher, It Ain't Me, Babe, and a comic of the same name, which was an all-woman comic book. Is that correct?
Well, kind of a little bit-ish. It Ain't Me, Babe was the first. In those days, we didn't call it feminism yet. We called it women's liberation. It Ain't Me, Babe was the first women's liberation newspaper in America. And it came out of Berkeley, of course. And I saw maybe the first or second issue, I don't remember, but a very early issue, and was very excited and contacted them and wound up drawing for them. Roughly every 3 weeks, we would have paste-up night, and we would just, I would do little spot illustrations right there, and you know, for the articles. And I also did a comic for the back page, and I did covers also.
You had an easier time working with underground newspapers than you had with underground comics.
You know, what happened was women's liberation happened. And along around the same time as women's liberation, underground comics, it was still a very small group of people. Right. But underground comics started getting, and it was all guys. You have to understand that. The women, it was me and one other woman, Willie Mendez. And the comics suddenly took a turn, I would say around 69, took a turn for the extremely misogynist.
Right.
And you have to understand that there was no comics code in underground comics. These guys could draw whatever they wanted. And what was coming out of their ids was an amazing hatred of women, really vicious, violent misogyny. I had gotten turned on to what we called women's liberation. And I think even if I hadn't gotten turned on to women's liberation, I would have, you know, still reacted the same way because this stuff was horrifying. Right. I objected to it. And the guys were extremely threatened by women's liberation. My God, they were so threatened. It was ridiculous. So basically, I was shut out. I mean, there was a boys' club, and I was definitely shut out.
This was driven by Robert Crumb, then, this kind of shift of the id toward this, those kind of comics?
Well, I hate to pick on Crumb, but it was kind of, you know, because he was a brilliant artist and a brilliant cartoonist, and he kind of became the god of underground comics.
Right.
And what he did was sacrosanct, you know, and if you dared to criticize him, you were burned at the stake in the marketplace.
Did he know about your objections to it?
Of course he did.
He did, right. And then did he give you any interpersonal reaction to it, or was it more systematic with the underground comics and just the people that were in it?
Well, he always said that, well, I'm being honest and this is what is in my head and I'm just showing it honestly, but that doesn't really make it, you know. Racists are honest too, you know?
Right, right. I get that.
You actually lived with his sister for a while.
She was my roommate, yes.
Right after your child had been born and she had a young child as well?
They moved in when I think my daughter was about 9 months old.
And how long did y'all live together?
Oh, we probably lasted about a year, but it wasn't a good living situation because unfortunately her son, who was just a little bit older and bigger than my daughter, Casey, she wasn't mean to him. She wasn't horrible to him or anything like that. She never abused him, but she practiced a kind of benign neglect. She just kind of left him alone to, wander around the house and get into things. And I think he was reacting. He felt, I mean, because she wasn't really giving him active love, he was reacting very badly and in really the most rage-filled baby I had ever seen. And,
took
it out on my daughter, who was younger and smaller, and it just was a bad living situation. So we finally split up. I always really liked Sandy and tried to remain friends with her.
And you included her story somewhat in a comic you did later on?
I love the way you're asking these questions, you know, because you're getting them all wrong, even though you've read my book and you know everything. That was the first issue of Feminist Comics in 1972. I did the story of Sandy becoming a lesbian. Sandy comes out. And I didn't know it at the time, but it turns out it was the first comic about an out lesbian ever drawn.
Oh, wow.
So what did I get wrong? I thought I was getting it pretty right.
Oh, but that's okay.
Okay.
Nice try, Jim. Nice try.
All right.
So, you know, I'm curious. Tell us about 1973 Berkeley Comic Con. You made some paraphernalia for that event.
Paraphernalia? I guess, yeah. I did t-shirts. Is that what you mean?
T-shirts. Yeah. Okay, cool. And tell us about that comic convention.
I did some ads for the Comic Con.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, it was great. Women's comics had started in 72. 2 weeks after we started women's comics, we discovered that there were these two women in Southern California who were also doing an all-woman book. And theirs had a much more outrageous title than ours. It was called Tits and Clits.
Right, right. That's right.
We didn't know about each other. And yet here, within 2 weeks of each other, you know, two different groups of women from either side of California were producing these all-women comics. Really, I know that it's silly, but I mean, was it the water? Was it something in the water? You know, so we all met in 73 and got along beautifully. You know, that was Lynn Shevely and Joyce Farmer.
You also did a all-women's comic based out of France as well, correct?
Oh, I contribute. See, that's what I mean about how you're getting them wrong. You did an all-woman's comic based out of France. Sounds as though I edited an all-woman French comic. And of course I didn't. I contributed.
Yes.
I contributed to Anana, which was the French. I've been told that they were inspired by women's comics, that it was
there
the French equivalent of women's comics, but it was really so much better because all the European artists were better than us.
How long were you actually in France for an extended period of time
We have something called the postal system so that you can mail them the art. You don't have to go to France to deliver it by hand.
Okay, but you were in France at the
point. I did.
I went
to France in 73. Yes, I did. And visited. Actually, I did not visit them in 73. I visited them in 77 when I went to Europe with my daughter, my 7-year-old daughter.
Okay.
And you met a lot of the great French artists at the time.
Yes.
Girard and others.
Yes. Stayed with Jean-Pierre Dionnet, the publisher of Metal Hurlant, and his wife, Jeannique, who was the editor of Anana.
Oh, nice. Yeah, 70 sounds like a really interesting time. Now, did you go back to New York for a while when in 74 you told me, I remember at the Cartoon Art Museum, we chatted a bit, that you went to Marvel and you met Stan Lee with your daughter in 74.
I went back to New York periodically. There were fantastic airline deals in those days where you could go round trip for $199, things like that. And I would stay with friends. Often I would stay with Flo Steinberg, who was a very dear friend of mine.
Oh, really? That's great. Yeah, because she did her own underground, Big Apple Comics.
Big Apple Comics.
In 1975.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a cool, I didn't know about that connection between you two.
You did. And
tell the audience about when you met Stan Lee with Marvel and he introduced you to comics like Night Nurse and things like that. Tell the audience about that scenario.
Actually, I met Stan Lee in 1966 when I came to New York from Los Angeles. And I visited Marvel to do a write-up on them for the LA Free Press. And they were great. I mean, they were just very welcoming. You could never do that now. You know, you'd have to make appointments. But I just walked in and said, hi, I'd like to interview Stan Lee and and Marvel Comics to write about Marvel for the Los Angeles Free Press. And I was made welcome. And Roy Thomas took me to lunch. And Stan was great. And, you know, it was really a remarkable time.
So then was this kind of your personal introduction then to the Marvel people was around this time then?
Yeah.
And then Dennis Kitchen, he published a few magazines under the Curtis Publications for Marvel, the comics book.
Comics book.
Which was like the mainstream Marvel underground magazine, kind of a conflicted category. But you did some excerpts because when I was researching you a bit, I got some of those and I read through them. And you had some Panthea comics that were in there.
Yes, I did. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So tell us about, were you doing those from San Francisco or were you in Manhattan doing those?
No, I was in San Francisco. Again, I call your attention to the United States postal system. So
there you go.
We just pop things. We didn't have to be there. That was amazing. I mean, because they were paying $100 a page, which was incredible for us underground cartoonists.
Oh, I see.
We were happy to get $25 a page if we even got paid.
Right. Yeah, the Panthea, I read that, and it's just the origin story of Panthea was just something else, because I guess a woman or a girl was kidnapped into the wild, or she was lost in the wild, and then she grows up and makes love to a lion?
Plane crashes, and yeah, she's the only survivor. She's a baby girl.
Right.
And she's brought up a lion and becomes his mate and gives birth to Panthea. Yeah, who is part lion, part woman.
Yeah, what an origin. When I read that, I was like, I've never read anything like that before. So definitely got my attention. So then what was your impression of the comics book? Why did that not last more than 3 issues?
I really don't know why it didn't last more than, was it only 3 issues? I thought it had 4 issues.
There was 3 under Curtis. Then he put together 4 and 5, I think, okay. On his own. Dennis Kitchen did.
Okay. You know, you can get the collected comics book. It's been published. The entire comics book. I don't know why it didn't last. It's too bad. It was great while it was going on.
But it was fun. And then you mentioned the Tits and Clits underground comics, and you worked on that in 1977.
No,
or you contributed?
She didn't work on that, did she?
I was a contributor. No, yeah. I did contribute.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. She did in 1977. And the mission seemed to be underground, but as sexuality from a woman's perspective.
Yes.
Which
yes.
was different, right, from the late 60s, early 70s, from the male sexual perspective.
Boy, I'll say.
And I looked at some of those pages, and they're very classy. Did you feel that that magazine achieved the goal of adequately viewing things from the reverse approach, gender-wise?
To a certain degree, yes. I mean, the guys didn't want to talk about women's sexuality, you know. The same thing with women's comics. I mean, we dealt with subjects that the guys would not be the least bit interested in talking about. You know, the first issue had a comic called A Teenage Abortion. She was still illegal. And we talked about menstruation. We talked about subjects that men didn't talk about, you know.
Right. Which I think are important to talk about. I mean, those are real things that they should be out there.
Of course.
Now, you were more involved in women's comics than you were in Tits and Clits.
I was an occasional contributor to some clips. I think I may have contributed to two issues.
There you go.
And you were actually an editor, at least for one issue of Women's Comics.
Two issues.
But there was comments made that you were almost in charge of it, that you were the de facto editor for more than that.
I was never in charge of Women's Comics. I was never the de facto editor. We had a rotating editorship so that no one could be a dictator. And in fact, starting in 1982, we had two editors, a double editorship, so that even then, nobody could be the supreme law.
Okay.
I understand that, but people have said that you were.
Well, this is simply not true.
But you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Maybe Jim's saying is that did you have to make some executive decisions every now and then?
Yeah. It was of the other people on there later
on. We really were a collective. Every month we would meet, and people from the first issue on, in the first issue, we solicited submissions and we got them. And every month we would meet and we would sit on the floor surrounded by submissions and go through them and offer our opinions. The editor would have the last say for sure, but all had say. And, you know, a lot of it was simply unanimous. If someone was simply awful, we all felt the same way. But every now and then we'd get something really exciting, something new, something that, you know, showed real talent. And it really was. Although maybe the editor had the last say, it was a collective decision.
Talk about the publishing of that. This was being done. Who was financing this?
My Last Gasp. Ron Turner was the publisher of Last Gasp Comics. And he had published today Me Babe Comics, which was the very, very first all-woman comic book in the universe, as far as I know. I don't know about Pluto, but I produced that one. That one, I take credit for that. I completely thought it up and produced it.
Nice.
Who were some of the men during this period that really did support women cartoonists and comics? I know you talked about Von Bode as somebody that really helped.
Von Bode.
Yes, Von Bode, sorry.
Yes, he was very supportive. Well, you know, like I said, there was a boys' club, and he wasn't part of the boys' club either. I think he felt very shut out. I think those guys resented him. Maybe he was just too talented for them. I don't know, but they did resent him. And there were other guys. In 1972, my partner was Leslie Cabarga, who was a cartoonist, underground cartoonist at the time, contributed to Comics Book. And he was, of course, supportive. I mean, I wouldn't have been living with him if he weren't supportive. There were lots of supportive guys.
Cool.
But and then there was that core of Boys Club.
And there were some that seemed to go out of their way to leave you out of a convention list and to leave you out of projects and panels. And you mentioned Roger Brand several times.
Yes, it was almost uncanny how much he went out of his way to not introduce me to anyone and to leave me out. It was really kind of mind-blowing. Yes.
I was reading where I think it was Spain Rodriguez, and I hope I don't get it wrong because you'll fuss at me. But Spain Rodriguez said that they weren't trying to actually freeze you out because you were women. It was just that your stuff was sweeter and they wanted to be vulgar and gross.
That's exactly what he said. To me, that was a great compliment because, first of all, that was when we were co-teaching a class back in the early 21st century in Chico. On comics, I was teaching the writing and he was teaching the drawing. We would have separate classes, but then the last class was the two of us together. And he said that he had read this in my book, My History of Women Cartoonists, a quote saying that there was a sweetness to women's comics. And he said that was really why they didn't want to publish me, because it was too sweet, because they didn't want to be sweet. They wanted to be nasty and raw and horrible. This was really an enormous compliment, you know, and it not only that, but it told me that he had read my book, which was a big compliment, too.
Yeah. So do you feel like when they want to be vulgar, is that just because it just gets more readers and it pays more? Is that basically all that is?
Well, no, it's what they wanted to do. It's little boys telling potty jokes. Come on, you guys, do you remember when you were horrible little boys? Well, these are just horrible little boys who never grow up.
I see. I gotcha.
Although I will say that the early women's comics have their own level of vulgarity. We have to they also were pushing boundaries quite a bit.
Some of them were quite vulgar, yes.
Tina, is there anything else you want to say in relation to... Well, one thing I want to ask you about, because I love this story, was where it was a party and the men kept wanting to basically split up and put the wives and women in the kitchen, and the men were going to go in another room and talk. And you were a cartoonist, too. What's that?
You keep getting them just a little twisted. This was 1970, and it was a dinner given at Roger Brand and his wife Michelle, given at their house, and they had invited other cartoonists. And at the time, I was living with Kim Deitch, and he was part of the Boys Club, so I came along. I was invited. But then after dinner, all the women went into the kitchen. And the men hung out together, you know, smoking pot and talking. And I was damned. I was a feminist. I was not going to go into the kitchen with a bunch of women. I was a cartoonist. I wasn't just a wife, you know. So right. I stayed with the male cartoonists. But then what happened was Roger kept leading them out of the room into another room. And I would follow them into that room. And then Roger lead them into another room. So it was like he kept moving away from me and leading the guys away from me. And I just kept following because I wasn't going to be left behind.
Wow,
it was a very weird situation.
That's great. I want to ask you about one other anecdote, which was you were being invited when you were living in New York. You were going to parties. Were they hosted by Archie Goodwin?
Yes. Archie and Ann Murphy, his wife.
You saw Steve Ditko there?
Yes, in a little gray suit.
And Bill Everett and Roy Thomas and Gil Kane and Walt Simonson, a whole blend of the past and the current ones, and they were all there at the parties. Talk about that a little bit and some of your encounters.
It was Flo Steinberg who invited me. I guess the first time I went, there was Roger again, Roger Brand, but he had never invited me. He had never told me about these parties. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I was invited." And it was great. I mean, I was, you know, I don't think that they took me seriously as a cartoonist, but they accepted me as a person and were very nice to me.
What year was that roughly?
That was 69.
Okay. So you saw
San Francisco.
But when you saw Steve Ditko and Roy Thomas and them, that was in 69?
Yes.
Oh, okay. How was Steve Ditko? Was that the only time you saw him around then, or did you see him other times?
I saw him twice. A little gray man in a little gray suit, standing all alone in the hall with a drink, not talking to anybody. And Ann Murphy, Archie's wife, came over and said, "Can I get you anything?" And he said, "No, I'm fine." And she just kind of looked at me and shrugged, and he walked. He left shortly after that. And the second time I saw him, he was at Woody's studio. I went to visit Woody, and he was there. And Woody said, "Oh, this is Trina Robbins. This is the girl I told you about," which was a great compliment to me that he actually told someone about me. And all of a sudden, Steve Ditko left. Woody said, "You're going? You're going so quick?" He said, "Yeah, I got to go." So
he didn't say much, I guess, those two times.
No.
Did you get the impression that Woody and him were friends?
I think they were.
Yeah. So Ditko was just, do you think he was just shy? I mean, I guess it's hard to tell from those few encounters, but.
I think he didn't like to hang out with people very much.
Yeah, that's okay. No, that's fair. That's interesting.
One other anecdote in terms of the parties. So I don't know if it was the last party you went to before you moved, but there was a party where you brought the brownies.
Yes, I made pot brownies. I felt that the parties were too staid, that everyone was just being a little too rigid and too straight. So I made pot brownies and brought them in. And I called them Alice B. Toklas brownies because she has a recipe for pot brownies in her Alice B. Toklas cookbook that are quite famous. And everybody ate the brownies and was having a wonderful time and just laughing and really loosening up. And at one point, Roy Thomas said, "What did you put in these brownies, Trina?" And I said, "Pot." He said, "I thought so."
That's great. Now, let's talk early 80s. You had basically a series of installments of Dope, of the comic Sax Romer's Dope book, but in comics form. In Eclipse Comics, it was kind of, they were released in a serial fashion as you went through the story. You wrote in the graphic novel, when I was kind of researching your stuff, that you felt like the elements of this story were perfect for a comic book. And you also said that you enjoyed it, reading it within the context of his time, because there's some racism and misogyny and this and that.
Yes. But
right. But you still value it as an artifact of its time. So I guess a couple of questions. What made it for a perfect comic book? And what advice would you give to younger readers as they look at old stuff like that? And how should they process that stuff?
Well, you know, I think we have to realize that by our standards in the past, everyone was racist. It's as simple as that. Really, truly, everyone was racist. I mean, if you read Charles Dickens, if you read Mark Twain, everyone was racist. They were, you know, they didn't know they were being racist. We have different standards now. But as for Dope, it's so visual. I mean, my God, it's got such a great villainess and such a great villain and such great characters. And it's just, it's so visual. It's so blood and thunder. Sax Romer was such a good pulpy writer that it just was made to be adapted into comics.
And I was so happy to see that come back in print because it's lovely. It's one of my favorite things you did.
It really holds up. Yeah. I think that in the 80s, I was at my best as an artist.
I have to say that we had Tom Orzechowski on your podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And he does such a good job on the lettering on that.
It's great. It was wonderful. He lived downstairs from us. You know, we lived in the same building. And I could just bring the pages downstairs to Tom.
Oh, that's great.
You mean back then he did?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, because that was when he was also lettering X-Men at the same time.
He's
so it's
such a good letterer. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
You were doing a lot of mainstream work then in previous years during this 80s period as well, because you did some work for DC, the Wonder Woman series, and you also did some Marvel work as well under Jim Shooter, correct?
Yes. And my attempt to bring back the girls' comics. Mm-hmm. With Misty, who was Millie the Model's niece.
Well, that was awesome. Trina, I know you're low on time. What we'll do is we will continue this off in a second segment in the future. Jim, any closing comments?
I just want to say how much I enjoyed this, but also I look forward to the second section where we talk about Trina as a comic historian and a scholar and an advocate for artists who were underappreciated at the time and unknown until she really started to make us aware of them.
Wonderful. Yeah, thanks so much for joining us here at the Comic Book Historian Podcast.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.